You all know Levy as a great chaplain. I know him not only as a great chaplain, but also as a great chap. And there's no more need be said than to say that the fact that you are all here today is a tribute to him, the tribute to his foresight, to his energy. I came here late Thursday night, and unfortunately, Levy was coming through a bout of the flu that got the entire family. His major anxiety was not about whether they would recover, but about whether I would catch it. Well, I haven't caught it yet. They've recovered. Everything is okay. I'm happy to present Levy Mayer.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Bilka. Would like to share with you some thoughts on the paper that I entitled The Loneliness Togetherness Dialectic. We've heard a lot about loneliness, and the first part of the paper is really a personal statement about myself, leading on to where it could be helpful to everyone. At the time that I wrote this paper, it was a time in my life that Carl Gustav Jung referred to as a time of a person's greatest potential psychological and spiritual growth. Many assumptions during that time in one's life are reevaluated, and insights are analyzed from new and different perspectives. I have encountered many situations here in the medical center. The most significant and critical events revolve around the caring for terminally ill patients and their families. Through these experiences, my awareness and sensitivity to the fragility of life and the inevitability of death have become extremely heightened. At the same time, I've been really blessed and privileged to have many friends throughout this, the patients, the families, the extended families, and they have become part of a permanent treasure that I cherish and frequently serve as an inspiration to me. Given all that, and given my hectic schedule, at the same time, I also feel lonely. This loneliness, however, is to be differentiated from being alone, from being alienated, or from being depressed. Many years ago, a very widely acclaimed article by Rabbi Soloveitchik, The Lonely Man of Faith, which I've read numerous times, talks about the lonely man of faith and talks about how loneliness is part of the man of faith and his life. But what Rabbi Soloveitchik does, he says, I'm only going to analyze it from a theological perspective, but not from a psychological. Today's paper, I would like to analyze the lonely man of faith from a psychological perspective. What does it mean to be lonely? In order to understand what loneliness is, there are two aspects of loneliness that I would like to address. One is loneliness from individuals, and the other is loneliness of a spiritual nature. When you're lonely as an individual, what frequently happens, you constantly think of yourself. You are not self-transcendent. Let me give you an example. There are two types of people who could play tennis. You can play tennis and be subjectively involved and really be totally there. Or you can play tennis and you say, I went to my cardiologist and my cardiologist said I should exercise and now I'm playing tennis. And even while I'm playing tennis, I'm thinking about myself as a being, a separate entity. And while you're enjoying yourself, quote unquote, playing tennis, you're obviously thinking of yourself. This brings about a sense of loneliness. Because in the midst of an activity which seemingly is enjoyable and hopefully you may want to do, you nevertheless detach yourself from that particular event. So when you have a thought or when you have a feeling, and then you have a meta thought, a thought on the thought or a thought on the feeling, it detracts from exactly what you're doing. So you become split. On one hand, you're involved. On the other hand, you're thinking about yourself as a separate entity. What about spiritual loneliness? What is meant by spiritual loneliness? In life, everyone in this room, everyone in the world, whether they have articulated it or not, has what's called a value system. And that value system works for most people most of the time. It comes a time in a person's life when something comes which is unprecipitated and unanticipated, whatever that may be. It may be turning the age of 40, 50, maybe having a grandchild, maybe encountering a tragedy, an illness, whatever. And suddenly, whatever value system you have had of a religious, spiritual nature, suddenly you find yourself completely empty and completely lonely. This is called spiritual loneliness. Both spiritual loneliness and human loneliness is basically very, very similar. The only difference is the union. In spiritual loneliness, the union is with God. In intrapsychic loneliness, the self is cut off. What happens and what can be done to mitigate this concept of loneliness? In order to understand what loneliness is, one has to look at its opposite. Take, for example, the concept of dark. You know why you understand light? Because there's dark. You know why you understand the concept of good? Because there is bad and evil. You know why we understand the concept of loneliness? There's also a sense of togetherness. What is meant by togetherness? I would like to say that togetherness means the ability to share one's being with another. It is a feeling of unity and union. It is a feeling that very, very few individuals have ever, of being completely, or at least in that direction, being understood by another. It becomes when two become one. The Mishnah had a very interesting phrase, and this has been interpreted in many different ways. But the Mishnah says that if you save one individual, it's like you save an olam, a whole world. And there were many medieval Jewish philosophers, Isaac Israeli amongst others, who said that every individual is an olam katan, a microcosm. So what happens when you have the ability to share something about yourself of a very personal nature with another person, you have created a olam katan, which is a dyadic oneness where two people can then become one. It is this special feeling and special ability to share that particular psyche with another that creates a type of cosmic unity and brings a feeling of togetherness and serenity. Now what happens? We described briefly loneliness, and we described briefly togetherness. Let's reflect back on loneliness. Here you have a person, let's say a person is 45 years old, and suddenly they feel lonely. What is that person usually thinking about? Although they have had 45 years, which may have had a marriage, children, a job here, other enjoyments, nevertheless, they're able to focus on three or four aspects which happened to them in their life. I'll give you a situation which is a clinical example. A person will say to me, I feel lonely. And I'll say, why? And they said, you know, when I was in the third grade, someone didn't speak to me for the whole year. And then they'll go on, when I was 20 years old and I attended my sister's wedding, my position in that line was not appropriate. And at the last job that I had, someone did not smile in the right way. So what happens is that this particular person is able to focus on a few desolate aspects of that particular person's past without any feeling of anticipation of the future on where they will be. Some of you may be familiar with the Beck Depression Scale. And one of the questions in the Beck Depression Scale of pessimism is the futuristic pessimism is reflected by, I feel I have nothing to look forward to. So you have a person who's 45 who cannot envision anything good happening in this coming year. And the only thing they can think of is the three or four lousy things that occurred that brings a feeling of loneliness and alienation and depression as well. So we have here a loneliness, and we have here a togetherness. What can be done to understand how this can work for all of us? I would like to take three examples to show how loneliness and togetherness can work in a positive way. The first example that I would like to pick upon, which has not been mentioned this morning, is the institution called marriage. Eric Erickson points out that before you can have intimacy amongst people, you need to have your own identity. Identity precedes intimacy, and it's very vital as a prerequisite for one's establishment, not only of self, but in terms of the marriage as well. This particular aspect of identity, in psychological jargon, is termed individuation, where you become aware of yourself as an individual totally different from your father, mother, brother, and sister, and totally different from anyone else in the world. You become your own olam katan, your own microcosm. You have individuated, you are a self, you are then ready for intimacy. Says the Torah, Al ken yazov ish es aviv es ima v'dovak be'ishto. Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave unto his wife. The Targum, one of the translators of the Torah, has a very interesting phrase. Instead of translating the word Al ken yazov ish es aviv es imo, the Targum translates this that it requires the individual to move out of your parents' home. The Targum understood that a young adult, when he's entering the aspect of intimacy, your individual psyche requires your own home. And then, and only then, v'hayu l'basar of echad, can they be one flesh. Eric Fromm mentioned a beautiful sentence that I have quoted frequently. What is meant by the art of love between husband and wife? When two become one and yet remain two. When two become one and yet remain two. V'hayu l'basar echad. The marital union is based on a person's struggle in the process of becoming individuated and being together at the same time. When you have a husband and wife, they each are on their own process of individuation, which goes on throughout life, and yet they are together at the same time. One of the most beautiful words in the Torah that I have thought about a lot for many, many years is the word Ezeh Kenegdo. Let me translate each word, and then let me suggest two or three interpretations what Ezeh Kenegdo means. It says as follows. Your spouse should be an Ezeh Kenegdo. The word Ezeh means help. The word Kenegdo means in opposition to. Together, if you look at most translations of the Bible, Ezeh Kenegdo is referring to your helpmate, your spouse. But the Talmud has said, I don't understand. Why is your spouse considered on one hand an Ezer, someone who's helpful, and on the other hand, someone who is Kenegdo, in opposition? So the Talmud has a suggestion. If you are meritorious, then your spouse will be helpful. If you are not meritorious, then your spouse will be Kenegdo, in opposition. Another interpretation which is offered is that each spouse has to be helpful in the aspect of helping the other individuate, even in that process of individuation may be different from yours. I would like to suggest another interpretation. At times, the bond between the husband and wife is reflective of complete harmony. At other times, the relationship can reflect profound destructive tendencies, overtly or covertly. Marital difficulties are not the result of pathologies or immaturity, but rather reflect a human marital pendulum of being very, very helpful and, on the other hand, being in opposition to. This reality is a mirror of loneliness and togetherness. What is the biblical word for sexual relations? The word is yada, to know. Now, what does it mean to know? Knowledge represents constantly one's ambivalent. Knowledge of another person can never be all-encompassing. It always must contain elements of doubt and uncertainty. Just like we have the opposites, faith and doubt, knowledge and uncertainty, love and hostility, all of this becomes part of what I would like to call the loneliness togetherness of the institution of marriage. You all know the phrase, to know oneself. What does it mean to know oneself? Since knowledge can never be obtained in entirety, it's the process of striving to constantly be aware of yourself and your spouse in a more profound way. The loneliness togetherness of husband and wife can be reflected by two people being intimate lovers at one time and at the same time intimate strangers at another time. And both can coexist, and both can be an ezer kenegdo. The second example of loneliness and togetherness is the area of man's search for meaning. You're all familiar, and in this room, at this podium, a number of years ago, I had invited Dr. Viktor Frankl, and he gave a talk at that time, The Meaning of Suffering. He has pioneered with his question of it's a lonely search for meaning, and I would like to suggest something which is based on what he had said. No matter how much reading a person does, no matter how much experience a person has, no one has ever found an absolute meaning for life. And I would like to suggest, and this is not meant to be an apologetic either, that the insolubility of either a universal or a particular meaning of life can be transformed to be the greatest benefit to all of humanity. Constant fluidity, meeting the perennial challenges of life, and the eternal search for meaning can endow everyone with a potential raison d'etre and a meaningful existence. Life is never meant to be fully understood. The Bible says that no one, not even Moshe, can see God and live. God is unknowable. Ipso facto, human life, which contains the Tzelem Elohim, the image of God, is also unknowable. Therefore, what is important is the dynamic search, and in that search, in and of itself, there will be some meaning in life. We all know what death is, but you know, death comes many times in a person's life. If a person has a stroke on the left side and they can't move the left side of their body, suddenly, for all basic purposes, the left side of the body is motionless. It's a type of death. As a result of physical rehabilitation and physical therapy, life becomes back. What do we mean that life comes back? Motion comes back. Dynamic motion comes back. Restfulness is not there. Movement and vitality reflect the individual and the subjective human endeavor in search for meaning in life. It's the movement and not the stagnation which sheds light on the meaning. Now, what happens in this room? All of us here, all 200 people, each of us are on our own journey, searching. We're searching in a lonely fashion, but knowing that each one of us is searching brings together a togetherness as well. My third example is a commitment to togetherness. I have noticed a very blatant dichotomy between a therapeutic relationship and a relationship which is not therapeutic. A therapeutic relationship will start off something like this. I have never told this to anyone before. Can I trust you with this issue of confidentiality? I feel so uneasy sharing my private thoughts. I am further concerned that if I share this, you may not like me, or you will think less of me. All these things represent that when a relationship is non-therapeutic, it means someone is constantly holding something in. What do they hold in? They hold in what Jung calls, what other psychologists call, the other side or the shadow of yourself. They want to project themselves as a complete rose without any thorns. What happens then? What happens when you cover up the other side? What happens when the shadow is only between you and your therapist? What happens is you develop a sense of extreme loneliness and leading to insanity. What is the other extreme? The other extreme is to be extremely open. You know where people are extremely open? People who are psychotic tend to be extremely open, and they say the truth as it is. And that's why we sometimes we call them psychotic. What is needed in human relationships is not either extreme of privacy or total openness, but some type of appropriate mutual sharing where this process can be a gap which you can overcome and where everyone will not find themselves in isolation. You know what will be acknowledged? It's the other side. It's the shadow. And all those things will be acknowledged. So we have a commitment to loneliness and togetherness, and this itself is a rhythm of life. It's like music. You're in loneliness, you're covering up a shadow, you open up the shadow, you're with the togetherness, a dyadic oneness, a cosmic unity, an olam katan, you feel okay, and life goes on. It's a dialectic. There's a very well-known commandment in the Bible, one of my favorite. It's called Hashavat Aveda, to return a lost object. Most of you are wondering, Rabbi Meir, I know there are many mitzvahs in the Torah, but why is your favorite Hashavat Aveda? Returning a lost object. Because of a comment that I saw on a painting in my office, and the comment was mentioned by Rabbi Leo Beck, one of the great theologians of the 20th century. He was known as the teacher of Theresienstadt, that even in concentration camp, somehow he was able to serve as an inspiration to all of his friends and colleagues. And he said to himself, if I find this pen, I have to return it to its rightful owner. Do you know what that means? That let's say something is lost about myself. Don't I have to return it to my rightful owner? And he said it very eloquently. He said, and a spirit is characterized not only by what it does, but no less by what it permits, what it forgives, and what it beholds in silence. And a spirit is characterized by what it beholds in silence. Says Rabbi Beck about the mitzvah of Hashavat Avedah, returning a lost object, yes, it's important to return this pen or pencil to its rightful owner, but you need to return yourself to yourself. You cannot constantly ignore. You need to restore yourself. You need to acknowledge your dark side. You cannot ignore a childhood emotional or sexual abuse. You cannot ignore a specific history of being a Holocaust survivor. You cannot ignore some sibling rivalry that may have taken place that may have left an indelible scar. You need to raise it to its consciousness. And you know what will happen when you raise it to its consciousness? It will become a time of celebration, a time of Yontif, like the high priest on Yom Kippur. It was a special celebration not only for the Jewish people, but for the high priest. What will that celebration include? That celebration will acknowledge the frailties of who you are. It will acknowledge the struggles that the way you were when you were 20 is not the way you are when you're 40 and not the way you'll be when you're 60. It will acknowledge the challenges that you must encounter on a daily life. When all this is accomplished, then you can begin to recite one of my favorite psalms, Psalm 23. But not while you lie on a deathbed, and certainly not at a funeral, not during difficult times in life, but as a celebration of life, when life can be lived to its fullest. And maybe you can say then as follows, the Lord is my shepherd. No one is lonely, either in life or in death. He will restore my soul. Throughout life, a person will constantly search for the inner voices of the soul, and try to be aware of all things, positive and negative. In that way, a person will be a partner with God in life and in death. After a funeral, what is the first thing that is done? The very first thing after Kaddish is recited. You ask all the people who have come to help to form two rows facing one another. And you ask the mourners to walk through. And as the mourners walk through, we recite the phrase, Hamakom Yenachem Eschem, may God comfort you. What is going on at that particular moment? I would like to suggest. It's after that moment that you have already said the Kaddish. After your father has been buried, where you feel a sense of complete loneliness, aloneness, alienation, depression, all of that. You walk by completely lonely. Your psyche is in a different state. But as you're walking, it's Hamakom Yenachem Eschem. There's a person to the right and a person to the left who will stand there as their angels of Gabriel and Malach and Malachi. And they together will guide you for the future. And in this way, you have provided a shurash al tanchumim, a row of comfort for the loneliness and togetherness. And the last thing, what is perhaps the most lonely time in a person's life that cannot be copied by anyone else? It's as you recite the last vidui, your last confession, the Shema Yisrael. What is the last vidui and what is the Shema Yisrael? Last year's conference, we read from Irving Altman, and I would like to share with you one sentence about his interpretation of Shema Yisrael. It's the last page of the journal. He says, "I am dying alone, as nobody can accompany me where I am going. I am on my own, as never before in my life. But just in this aloneness, just in this loneliness which I am facing now, I am closer to God's identity and His aloneness than ever before. In this true aloneness, I experience and recognize my own very divinity from within, in the image of God." And that's why it says, Yatsa Nishmaso Be'echad. When you say that last word of Shema Yisrael, the loneliness of yourself and the loneliness of God merge to create togetherness of humanity and divinity.